Welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I am John Charles, and today I am honored to have with us debut author Tara Shelton Harris, whose new book, One Summer in Savannah, will be published this July. Before we begin today, I do want to let those listening in know that the Poison Pen does have copies of One Summer in Savannah on order, and we would be happy to hold one for you or put one in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen Bookstore. And now I would like to welcome debut author Tara.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. As a reader, I'm always fascinated by how writers got to where they're at. So I always like to know their backstory, I guess you'd call it. And If my research is correct, you grew up in a small town in Illinois?
I did. I grew up in a teeny tiny town in Southern Illinois. I was born in Chicago, but I grew up in Southern Illinois. One of those K through 12 schools, which lets you know just how small it was. And I have always wanted to write. I have run from it quite a bit, or wrote around or did around writing, but I've always wanted to be a writer. I remember my sixth grade teacher, her name is Julie Cook. She would see me during breaks just writing. And she really, really encouraged me to do that. And I remember she asked me to read my story that I had been writing in front of the class. And I was nervous, of course, but when I got up there and I started reading the story, like, I saw the reactions from my classmates. They were laughing, they were smiling. And just seeing that emotion coming from something that I wrote just really like sparked that in me. And I knew that right then, I knew I wanted to write. And then, but I wasn't sure what kind of writer I wanted to be. I'm Generation X. So, you know, we didn't see a lot of these professions growing up. And back then, writing was mixed in with art. So it was that starving artist thing. You can go write, but how can you make a living doing that? Yeah. So we weren't encouraged back then to write. So I knew that if I was to write, I'd have to go into newspapers. And I thought maybe I'd be a journalism major. So I started off as a journalism major. Maybe I wanted to just write for newspapers. But even then, newspapers were starting on the decline. And so I didn't know what to do from there. So from there, because I just assumed that writing novels and books was just going to be out of my league. And so I started freelancing. So I was a freelance travel writer for a long time. So I would go update guidebooks and write articles and visit all these different countries and write about my experiences there, until I just finally just one day just said, you know what, I'm going to try my hand at writing a book. And so I did. And that book lives on my shelf. I mean, lives on my hard drive. It was not published, but I learned so much from writing that book. I learned so much about myself. I learned so much about the industry. And so I said, okay, this is going to be my practice book. That's what I call it. And I'm going to give it a go again. And that second chance was One Summer in Savannah.
What was the book's path to publication? You wrote it, and was it like an overnight sensation, or did you have to really do the rounds with it? How did it get to its right home?
I love this question because I walked backwards into publishing One Summer in Savannah. So it was my COVID book. I love hearing writers say this was a COVID book. I started in February 2020, and a couple of weeks later, my library closed for 3 months. So I was able to go home and really lock in writing. And so when my library opened back up again, I was locked in. And so I started pitching it in January of 2021 and started out the gate with all these full requests. Wow. And I thought, okay, here we go. This is it. And slowly those full requests came back as rejections. And so I stopped, I revised for a minute, and started sending them back out again. And then that's when I saw my editor, Erin, on Twitter. And she tweeted something else, nothing about writing. And so I looked at her profile and I saw that she was open to unagented Black authors. And I thought, I can pitch an editor directly. Like, I wasn't quite sure. I knew that this was not normal. Yeah. So I added her to my list of all the agents that I was querying at the time. And didn't think anything else about it until November. So I had already been pitching for like 11 months and still had a lot of full requests out. And she emails me and she says, I love your first 50 pages. Can you send me the rest? And I was excited, but then that excitement quickly died because I realized I've been going through this for 11 months. Like I've been getting that, hey, we love it, and then nothing. And so I refused to get excited about it until a month later, right before Christmas, the best Christmas gift ever. she emailed me and said, I loved it. I loved the end, made me laugh and cry at the same time. And then I realized, and then she said, you need to get an agent. And I realized, oh yeah, that's right. Like, I don't have an agent. Mm-hmm. So my story is very unique because I had my book deal before I had my agent. And so I had to approach all these agents and say, hey, I have a book deal. Would you like to represent me? And let me tell you, that process was a lot easier when you already have a book deal in hand.
What can you tell us about One Summer in Savannah? What would you like readers to know?
Okay. I would like readers to know that it tells a story of a woman who conceives a child through sexual assault and has to decide whether or not to allow her attacker's family into her daughter's life, a process and something that's made even more difficult when she falls for the identical twin brother of the man who assaulted her.
It's, if you just hear about it, you think, how's that going to work? But you do make it work because I think one of the important themes you really address in the book is forgiveness. And it's something that we as individuals, myself included, sometimes don't want to think about because it's not something that's easy or comfortable, or it makes you uncomfortable, I guess.
That's right. I work as a collection development librarian. That's majority of my responsibilities. And so I get the opportunity to read several hundred books for work and for pleasure, but I also get a chance to talk to patrons, and I always ask them, what are you reading? What do you like? And of course they love those, you know, the popular authors, they love them, but they also love debut authors. And they also love stories that they've never read before. So those new and diverse and unique stories. So I knew if I was to ever write a book that I wanted to write something that would be difficult to find something similar to on the shelf. And even when I was trying to find comps for One Summer in Savannah, I struggled. Even with my collection development background, I struggled being able to identify books. And I came up with two that were very similar to, or somewhat similar. And it was The Atonement Child by Francine Rivers, which tells the story of a woman who conceived a child through sexual assault. And then We Were the Mulvaneys by Joyce Carol Oates, which tells the story of what happens to a family after the daughter is sexually assaulted and how that sexual assault completely impacted and changed the dynamics of that family. And so that's the Jacob part of One Summer in Savannah, is the book We Were the Mulvaneys, and just how much this sexual assault just really altered his family's dynamics. So.
And if I understand correctly, a real historical event kind of inspired you in a way to write this story. And that,
yes,
that event itself was so amazing. I remember when it happened, just thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are actually two events that serves as inspiration for One Summer in Savannah. So after I shelved my first book, I knew, based on talking to my patrons, I knew I wanted to write something different and unique, but I had no idea what that was. And so I waited. And I remember the South Carolina church shooting and just being just devastated by that event. But I remember a few days later, and I was watching the news and I saw that the survivors and their family members, they walked into that courthouse days after and forgave the shooter. And I just remember thinking, whew, I don't know anything about forgiveness. Because like most people, I assume that there were acts and crimes and behaviors that it's okay not to forgive. And when they did that so quickly, I realized, wow, I don't know enough about forgiveness. I have never defined forgiveness for myself. And so I knew then that I wanted to write a book that challenged readers' definition of forgiveness, the way my definition of forgiveness was challenged. So I had a theme of forgiveness, but I didn't have a story yet until one day someone very close to me, a very close friend, shared something with me that I did not know, that she had conceived a child through sexual assault. And in our conversation, she used these words. She says, "And I practice the act of forgiveness every day." And I realized that I had a story that matched the theme. And I asked her if I could share her story. And she said, yes. And even when I was writing, in the writing of One Summer in Savannah, and a little bit after, whenever we were going through the process, she called me and she said, when Roe v. Wade was overturned, and she said, see, this is why I want you to share this story, because there will be millions more Sarahs of the world. And this story, One Summer in Savannah, kind of sheds a light on an even darker side of sexual assault that we don't talk about. Conception after sexual assault is rarely covered in fiction, and yet it happens to thousands of women every day.
Mm-hmm. That's true. The book is filled with little pearls of your writing wisdom. And one of the things that you had said was forgiveness takes more strength than anger. And that really is true.
It really does. And throughout the book, Sarah's still very desperate to protect Alana from the Wilders. And she's still very angry. She is time has passed, but you don't forget something like that happened to you. And she still has that anger, but yet she still wants to protect her daughter just based on everything that she went through. And to move past that, everything that Sarah does in One Summer Savannah is about the love of her child for Alana and about the protection of Alana. And sometimes that meant putting aside her personal feelings and her trauma for the better of for Alana.
Yeah. You also kind of, there's like almost a mirror image of what a mother will do for their child when you talk about Birdie and what she did for Daniel.
Yes. I mean, there's really no difference between, there's a slight difference, but ultimately they both were about protecting their children, whether it was right or wrong. I mean, I think that's one of the lines in the book, whether it's right, that Sarah says, whether it's right or wrong, they both were about protecting their children. And that's what Sarah was willing to go through to protect Alana. But Birdie also was willing to do all these things to protect her son, Daniel, as well.
Mm-hmm. And just in case anyone who's listening in thinks, how can an author handle such a difficult subject and make it seem true? You do. I mean, it's not an easy journey for any character in the book. It doesn't happen overnight. Forgiveness isn't granted the next day. You make a very strong case for why we should forgive people, but you also show that there's cost to it and there's some pain involved in forgiving people.
There is. And I think in my learning and defining forgiveness for myself, I've learned a couple of things. I learned that society tends to tell us who we should and should not forgive. And we don't define it for ourselves. We listen to other people. And when they say things like, oh, I could never forgive that. And we think, oh, well, I should never forgive that too. You know, I've talked to people that were like, no, I could not be in Sarah's shoes and do what Sarah did. And that's fine. But Sarah decided and had to decide for herself and what was better for herself and for her daughter. And that may not look the same for the next Sarah. You know, it varies. Sarah's situation and her circumstances were completely different than, say, another Sarah. And so I think we need to define forgiveness for ourselves and evaluate each situation differently. But in my definition of forgiveness, I've learned is, and really try to tell people, is forgiveness is for the healing person. It is not for the other person. It does not absolve the other person of their wrongdoings. It doesn't. Forgiveness is for the person that's giving it. So they are realizing that the past couldn't be any different. Like this is, it happened and it couldn't be any different. And it's just about moving on. Sarah, in her running and staying away for so long, realized that she was hindering Alana. She thought she was protecting and helping her, but she's a literal genius that needed to be around other people and needed to learn and need different tutors. So in her helping, she was hindering. And so sometimes we have to move past our traumas and the things that we see for the betterment of someone else. And that doesn't mean that you are forgiving that person for what they did. You're forgiving yourself and you're just trying to move on.
That's so perceptive. You have a lot of other things in the story that I found fascinating. One is kind of this whole turn towards mathematic equations and things like that. I had no idea there were like three mathematical equations that people are still trying to solve, but I'm not a
math person. That's right. I needed something. I needed even more of a reason for Sarah to return home. I mean, she returns home to take care of her father and run his bookstore, but I needed to show and highlight Alana in some way and to really make it more about her father, but also about Alana and her best interest. And so I thought about, why not make her smart, make her a genius? And so that's what I kind of honed in on. And in my research, I had to do some research on geniuses, because it turns out that there are different types of geniuses in the world.
Oh.
And I chose hers to be mathematics and foreign languages. You know, she picks up several foreign languages pretty quickly, but that's an actual type of a genius that you can be, which I found that to be very fascinating.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Another kind of more whimsical, I guess you could say, element to the story was one of your characters speaks in poetry. And I'm guessing mm-hmm. that love of poetry and how you share it comes from the author herself.
Yes. So they say, write what you know. And this is an example of me writing what I know. I'm an English major. I love poetry. From elementary, even till now, I have several poetry books I just love. And I knew I wanted to possibly incorporate poetry into this. And Jose, Sarah's father, is loosely based on my grandfather, who, whenever I was young, he suffered a stroke and lost his ability to speak. So he was mute for the rest of his life. But we were able to understand him through gestures and sounds that he would make. And so I thought, why not use a little bit of that? And so, Jose is, without me saying so, is on the spectrum. But back then, you know, when I was growing up, people weren't diagnosed as autistic or having ADHD and all these things as they readily are today. And so for Jose, for his ability to just stop speaking is something that can happen and happens to people just about every day. So I thought maybe I would have him incorporate some poetry into his language. And then I just decided, why not all? And so I remember my first early readers, I said, I'm going to see what they have to say about this. And they loved it. So I didn't change it. And then as far as the poems that were used, a lot of those were my favorites. I'm a huge Walt Whitman fan. I love William Butler Yeats. Like, those are my, Emily Dickinson, those are my favorites. So a lot of them were first nature to me. And I think there was only a few that I actually had to look up to make it match. But for the most part, those were the ones that I like. And they were ones that were in the public domain. So I was able to use.
Yeah, that's important for an author.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your own writing process, because if I remember correctly, you prefer to write in hand rather than type it on a computer.
I do. I am a hand. I'm a long hand. I think the words just flow faster and differently whenever I write. I write with a pencil and a piece of paper. And my husband, he finds like my little pieces of paper for ideas that I have just written down all over the house, because my memory is horrible. And so if I don't write it down right then with whatever I can find, I'm going to forget. And so I handwrite everything. I handwrote my first book, my second book that's coming out next year. And I'm handwriting my next one, just because it's just a lot easier for me. And then I transcribe that and I type it up. And that's when I edit as I am typing it up. So I edit as I go along. I know that's a big no-no in writing, but it's just my process and what works for me. As I'm typing it, I'm able to kind of polish it then. And so, but yeah, I love, and I've met a few other writers that write their books longhand. And I guess it's just, some people say it's old school. I wouldn't say old school, as I would just say, whatever works for you and however your process is. I don't see scenes when I write. I hear voices, and my voices, my characters talk to me, speak to me. And that just translates better to me if I just write it out by hand.
That's interesting. One Summer in Savannah is your debut book. Now that you've kind of gone through the publishing mill a bit, if you could go back to when you were first starting out as an author, what advice would you give yourself? What would you want to know about this whole crazy business of writing books?
Write your story that you want to tell, I think, and keep going. After my first book, after I failed to find an agent and a publisher for my first book, I took a long time off, several years before I started One Summer in Savannah. And I was a little discouraged, just because I thought, like most writers, I thought this was a good book. And I was discouraged by that it did not find a home. And I took some time off from that. And I wish I hadn't. I wish I would have started turning my ears and my eyes open to that next idea sooner than what I did. But then also, I feel like that said, I also feel like you still do need to wait for that right story to come along. The pieces for One Summer in Savannah did not come together immediately. I had the theme and then I had the story later, and then it was brought together. And sometimes you have to wait for that to happen if you don't already have an idea for a story. And then the next advice I would give is, you know, you never know what the market is. I know writers, you know, they try to write to the market, and I highly disagree with that. I think you should write the story that you want to write. And when I told people that I was writing a book about a woman who conceived a child through sexual assault, people were like, wow. But yeah. that was my story. And even despite people's reaction, that's a story that I wanted to tell. And that's a story that I told.
I think that's smart of you to say that, because writers and the writing process don't come in one size or one flavor or one style. You have to find what works for you. And
that's right.
Vampire romances may be popular now, but by the time you write a book about vampire romances, that craze has come and gone. So
that's right.
What you want.
I finished writing One Summer in Savannah of November of 2020. It debuts on July 4th, 2023. Mm-hmm. So that lets you know that if you started writing for the market when you first started writing through the whole entire process, several years have gone by. So that whole, whatever that crave is completely gone. Could be possibly by the time your book actually hits the shelves.
You did say something about some more books coming. Is there anything you can tell us about them, or would you prefer to keep that?
I asked this question if I could start to talk about it. It's my next one is titled Long After We're Gone. And it tells the story of four siblings who return home after their father dies to save their ancestral land and themselves. It's a family drama. And with One Summer in Savannah and with Long After We're Gone and just all of my books, they're all inspired by true events. And I just fictionalize those true events. And so Long After We're Gone tells a story. It's inspired by these two brothers who went to prison for 8 years to fight for their ancestral land. And so there's a lot of that still happening today, eminent domain and governments and these large corporations trying to take what was not valuable land then, but is valuable land today. And so it's loosely inspired by those two brothers. Mm.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about Tara as a reader. What was your journey as a reader like? Did you always love to read? Do you read across genres? Is women's fiction, relationship fiction kind of your jam right now?
Yes, I have always read. I mean, from the time that I could hold a book, I'm a huge reader, always. And I read fast. I read and I listen to a lot of books. Mm-hmm. I prefer now audiobooks. Audiobooks have just grown in popularity, leaps and bounds. And so with audiobooks, I found that I can listen to them faster because I listen to them in the car. I listen to them while I'm at work. And so I can get through books faster by listening to them. So I appreciate that. I read across all genres. I read everything. As collection development librarian, I kind of read, you know, like I said, a couple hundred books for work and for pleasure just to see, you know, what I'm missing or what we need on the shelves. I love fiction. I make myself trying to gravitate toward nonfiction because I could just easily just stay in fiction. But what I love about nonfiction is the narrative nonfiction that is almost like novel, like a novel. So some of that true crime, some of that stuff can kind of lend itself. It feels like fiction or like a novel. So yeah.
Is there any progress towards making One Summer in Savannah in audio format?
Yes, there will be an audiobook that will be released on July 4th as well. So that makes me really happy.
How much input did you get into like selecting the narrator and stuff like that?
I did not get any input, but I honestly got no input, but I'm just happy and blessed that there is one. Mm-hmm. As a librarian, I understand we have my readership in my library system is 40% audio. Mm-hmm. Almost half of my readers listen to books instead of, you know, turning the pages. And I know that a lot of them, if the book is not on audio, they'll never read it. And so I stress the importance of making sure for authors that if you could have or have a say so and have your book turn into an audiobook, that would be great, because that would introduce you to so many more readers. Because if not, readers may not pick up the book. And I know there are books, audiobooks that are Audible exclusives. And so when they ask me, oh, Tara, you know, is the library not going to get this book? And I have to kindly tell them, I'm sorry, it's not available for us. It's an Audible exclusive. But it pains me because I know that that reader will never listen to that book, will never read that book. Yeah,
that's true. Your book is a very serious and thoughtful book. There's moments of humor in it too. And I know that there are different books for different readers. Do you have any books personally, authors that you like that may be a little bit more on the lighter side?
Yes, I am writing friends with Nikki Payne. She writes Black romances. She wrote Pride and Protest. I love that book. It was so funny and so witty. It's a true rom-com. And so her, and then I have, I like Emily Henry books. I like Emily Giffen books. They're heavy, but they can have heavy topics, but they're also more on the lighter side. But honestly, I love bittersweet. I like to tell people that I write books with bittersweet endings. I don't mind reading heavy books because that's just where I feel like my heart tends to go. So I don't mind reading heavy books.
Yeah. And I think your book illustrates is there's a book for every kind of reader. You may not enjoy historical fiction or romantic comedies, but you can always find something you like. But just because you as a reader don't appreciate a book or want to read a book doesn't diminish the value of that book. It's just not the right book for you.
Absolutely. And I tell people that. I tell people it's fine to put a book down. If you if it's not for you, then that's fine. It's okay to close that book. And I think so many readers that I come across feel like they have to finish reading a book if they don't like it. And while I appreciate them reading outside their comfort zone, which is something I do encourage people to do, to try it. And if you're in that and you're reading and it's not for you, it's okay to close it. It's okay to not finish a book that's not for you. And I'm also appreciating that more and more writers are including author's notes and including trigger warnings for people. That's kind of warning people that there may be some things in here that's difficult for them. So I think that's making readers choose these books a lot easier and be better about what they select.
Yeah, that's true. And I think you're right. We should, as readers, occasionally challenge ourselves. Not every single book we read has to be a challenge, but once or twice a year, pick something up that you would not ordinarily read and give it a whirl and see what happens.
That's right.
What amazes me, and this kind of ties in a little bit to what you said, is as a reader, as someone who used to work in libraries, works in bookstores, I can't understand why so many people, it seems like, are so passionate about not wanting other people to read certain books. It's like, if you don't want to read it, fine, that's okay. But why are you so upset when someone else likes a book?
Yeah, that baffles me as well. I don't understand that. Like, it's fine that you like romances. It's fine that you like Christian fiction. It's fine that you like horror, but you should not have the ability to decide what everyone else in this library system should read. I was at ALA last week and Amanda Gorman was the closing speaker. And she talked about how devastating that was for one woman to be able to have the ability to pull her book off the book, off the shelf. And it was fine. Amanda said, it's fine that, you know, maybe it wasn't for her, but how does she have so much power to be able to stop other little boys and girls from reading that book? And so that's something that as a librarian, I'll never understand. I read widely, and maybe I don't read a lot of Westerns. Maybe I don't read a lot of horror, but I don't feel the need that I should be able to have the power to tell someone that they can't read it either.
Mm-hmm. That's true. We're almost out of time. I can't believe how quickly it's gone by. Can readers find out more about you through social media? Do you have a website? Are you on TikTok? What's your platforms?
Yes. People can find me on TaraSHarris.com. I am on Instagram and a little bit on Twitter, not as much. I'm on Instagram more than anything else.
That's wonderful. It's been just a delight and a pleasure and an honor having author Tara Shelton Harris here for her new book, One Summer in Savannah. I'd like to thank you, Tara, for coming, visiting us virtually today, for writing such a truly deep, powerful, and also in its own way, entertaining book.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
And thank you for tuning in, those listening, to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.